Besides its beautiful beaches, the Tampa Bay area boasts a rich collection of art museums, and it's growing. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the National Foundation for Transplants. Right now, hundreds of Tampa residents need an organ transplant they can't afford. You can join National Foundation for Transplants Operation Second Chance at transplants.org to learn how to help give someone a second chance at life.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. WUSF has been infusing a little art into our news with an occasional series called Art Populi. This time around, we feature museums and galleries around Tampa Bay. Today on Florida Matters, we'll hear those stories. Marching protesters, a bebop jazz pioneer, and a St. Petersburg drag queen all have at least one thing in common. Their images are part of an exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts, St. Pete's first art museum. Kathy Carter takes us to the MFA for the exhibit, Can I Get a Witness? Photographs by Herb Snitzer.
In his memoir, Glorious Days and Nights, Herb Snitzer wrote that his camera allowed him to experience things he couldn't have dreamed of, from late-night ping-pong games with Thelonious Monk to winning a Lifetime Achievement Award from the NAACP in St. Petersburg. The photographer has seen a few things in his 80-plus years, and he was there to capture it all in pictures.
Timing is everything, I think.
Snitzer's photographs hang on the walls of the country's most important museums. The St. Petersburg resident is a Philly native and was drafted to serve in the Korean War before receiving a diploma from the Philadelphia College of Art in 1957.
And the day I graduated, got my brother's Mercury and drove to New York and never went back.
Snitzer arrived in New York just in time to experience the free spirit atmosphere that was blooming in Greenwich Village in the late 1950s and early 60s.
In the vicinity of Washington Square is the Bohemian section, or Greenwich Village, where those with artistic ambitions absorb the atmosphere of art.
At the time, the neighborhood was home to a collection of poets, artists, and musicians that are now considered to be cultural icons.
It was a time of transition, a time of transformation. It just was magical.
Snitzer says he got his first job by opening up a phone book and cold calling photographers. He was soon hired as an assistant for $40 a week, and on his days off, he worked on making his own photographs.
In those days, long ago, photographers always had their camera around their neck, and I was no exception.
Because the magazine industry was the dominant medium of the era, it didn't take long for Snitzer to start making a living as a full-time photographer. As an artist, he took inspiration from French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, an early pioneer of candid photography as an art form.
He tried to get the image in one exposure. No cropping, no changing of the light. And I thought, that's an interesting aesthetic.
Through the years, Snitzer has become known for his images of jazz musicians, but he also focused much of his work on portraits of social justice. Several of those pictures are included in the MFA exhibit. One entitled NAACP is of a 1958 civil rights protest. It foreshadows the artist's volunteer work with the NAACP in St. Petersburg, which gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2005. Snitzer moved to St. Pete in 1992. He's still engaged in community activism, and he says his involvement with the city's Quaker congregation has inspired his evolving worldview.
I think I'm less intense. I think I'm more caring for others, and I work on that all the time, even at this age.
Snitzer says throughout his life, he's often wondered why people make art. And at the age of 86, he says he may have found the answer.
Because they want to be known 100 years from now. Most people are gone after 3 generations, just forgotten. I mean, I find that really sad.
So, he says, maybe all he's really doing is saying that he wants to be remembered. For Florida Matters, I'm Kathy Carter.
We heard Kathy mention Herb Snitzer's iconic photographs of jazz musicians. Now we'll learn about some of the ones on display in the MFA exhibit.
when Herb Snitzer was photo editor for the jazz magazine Metronome in the early 1960s, he occasionally got complaints from subscribers. Why, they asked, were there not more stories about the white musicians of the era, like Benny Goodman? Snitzer says the reason was simple. The magazine was intent on covering what they knew to be true. Jazz, more than any other music, expressed the black experience in America.
Especially during that period of time, they not only had to fight the racism, they had to fight the fact that they weren't even recognized as people.
As we walk through the gallery, Snitzer reminisces about the stories behind the images and the artists in them. One of his best known was made during a summer road trip when Snitzer traveled with Louis Armstrong as his band toured the country in a converted school bus. The photo is of Armstrong holding a cigarette. It was a hot day, so his shirt is unbuttoned, and a Star of David hangs from a chain around his neck.
Given to him as a birthday present when he was a little boy, which he wore his whole life.
The necklace was given to Armstrong by a Jewish family who lived in Storyville, the same poor neighborhood in New Orleans where the musician grew up. This family also gave him money to buy his first musical instrument, a kindness Snitzer says the trumpet player never forgot.
He always had a Jewish bass player. I think that it was payback. And I'll stand by the story. It's a great story. I hope it's true.
Snitzer also spent a lot of time with one of the first ladies of jazz, Nina Simone. The two met in 1959 when they were both in their 20s, and the photographer was hired to shoot the cover for the singer's second album, The Amazing Nina Simone.
She was open, lovable, and all the other positive adjectives one could put on her.
I put a spell on you.
A photo from that session depicts Simone looking joyful with sparkling eyes and a big, wide smile. It's a bittersweet image since the singer had a long history of depression and was a victim of domestic abuse. Snitzer acknowledges that Simone's struggles changed the girl he once knew and how later in life she became known as difficult to work with.
But I loved her. You know, people wanted to always get me to say something terrible about her, but I never will.
Snitzer was also behind the lens of a famous Miles Davis photograph taken the year before he died. The African-American trumpet player is dressed entirely in black with several gold chains around his neck. The musician looks pensive as he takes questions during a 1990 press conference at the Newport Jazz Festival.
And Miles was thinking about how he was going to answer. And it was at that point, with the combination of the gold and the black T-shirt and the black skin, I couldn't stop photographing.
Davis was known for having a volatile personality. Snitzer experienced this firsthand when Davis caught him snapping photos during a concert, one supposed to be off-limits to photographers.
Now, Miles had a reputation of hitting people, and I thought to myself, he's not going to stop playing. So I just kept photographing.
And Snitzer hasn't stopped. At 86, his muse these days is the people in his home of St. Petersburg. He says he hopes their photos and the ones of the jazz musicians now on view at the MFA has helped bring all of them into better focus. For Florida Matters, I'm Kathy Carter.
The University of South Florida Contemporary Art Museum in Tampa is taking an unusual tact to show off about 50 hidden gems from their collection of over 5,000 pieces this summer with a display called Restricted. Florida Matters' Mark Schreiner recently toured the display with the museum's executive director, Noel Smith.
The first thing I wanted to know is about the marketing of the exhibition. Think of the rating you'd see on a movie poster, a big black and white letter R next to the word restricted. Smith explains that that doesn't necessarily mean what you think it does.
Really, this show deals with ideas of conservation and access to museum collections. So all of the works that are in this show are works that we don't normally show for one reason or another. It can be because, yes, sometimes it's risque. We don't want to always be showing nudes in places that people might not expect them, but also works that perhaps are very difficult to install. Some of the works are very large. and so they're difficult to find spaces to exhibit them. Some of the pieces are very light sensitive, and so you can't have them shown. You have to really control and monitor where they're shown. So there's a number of issues here of why we very rarely bring these pieces out for public display.
How do they get chosen?
What we did, we asked the collection staff to pull out lists of all the works that we consider to be restricted, and we would choose ones that we would be particularly interested in seeing. So it's actually, the show really reflects a kind of group aesthetic and group choices.
So in addition to sometimes the beauty or the challenge that a piece of art provides the viewer, there's also a real bit of a history and educational component to it, isn't that?
Absolutely. I think works of art really speak a lot about our culture. They speak about our problems and solutions, especially contemporary artists who deal a lot with interdisciplinary problems, social problems. Their concerns go way far besides just aesthetic concerns, so that certainly is a major consideration. So our collection here, we consider to be almost like a library.
Where are these pieces normally located?
The main part of our museum is not our exhibitions area. Our galleries are only 5,000 square feet. The rest of it is mainly collections area. So all our works on paper and also paintings, sculptures are all stored in that area, which is very specially climate controlled, humidity controlled.
Were there moments when everyone was going through things and just suddenly maybe someone would go, oh my God, I forgot we had this here?
There were a lot of instances of that where we were just completely surprised.
I noticed during the summer, the exhibitions seemed to be a little more, I don't want to use the word fun, but it's not your usual, here is a collection from a specific artist or a collection of a specific set of works around one theme. It's really this kind of look inside that we normally don't get. Why do they do that here at the museum?
Well, it is an opportunity to bring out certain aspects that we usually don't. Also, keep in mind that every major exhibition that we do is a major commitment of time, effort, funding, etc. And so these exhibitions in the summer give us a little time to breathe and maybe plan ahead.
That's Noelle Smith, Executive Director of the USF Contemporary Art Museum, talking about the exhibition Restricted. It runs at the museum on USF's Tampa campus through August 4th. For Florida Matters, I'm Mark Schreiner.
You're listening to Florida Matters. We'll continue our tour of some of Tampa Bay's art museums, but first we're going to take a short break. I'm Robin Sessingham, and we'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham. We're listening to stories from WUSF's occasional Art Populi series, and this time around, we're taking a look at some of the many art museums in Tampa Bay. The number of privately owned art museums around the world is booming, with wealthy individuals opting to open their own museum rather than donate to an existing gallery. Florida Matters producer Stephanie Colombini visits downtown St. Petersburg, where this growing trend is evident in some new museums.
Since visitors started walking the halls of the Museum of Fine Arts in 1965, much has changed in St. Petersburg's art scene. The MFA, a public museum, gets some government money and has to meet certain legal and ethical standards. And spokeswoman Julie Wilson says it offers a comprehensive collection ranging from ancient mosaics to contemporary photography.
A little bit for everyone. No matter what you like, you can find something here.
But the latest wave of museums to open in the city are privately owned and niche, focusing on one artist or artistic style. One example is the Tom and Mary James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art, which opened in April. The former chairman of Raymond James Financial and his wife have collected about 3,000 works over the years and displayed most of them in his company headquarters. Now over 400 pieces are housed in a museum for the public.
My kids don't want all that art. We solved 13% of the problem.
James funded the not-for-profit museum with about $75 million of his own money. The billionaire says he was looking for a way to give back to the region where he made his fortune and spent most of his life.
What are you going to do with money? You're going to give it to the government and you're going to spoil your kids more? We're 75 years old. What are you going to do? You might as well do something that's a contribution to the community.
That charitable spirit's what Mark Ormond, director and curator of exhibitions at Ringling College Galleries in Sarasota, says usually drives collectors to open up museums. But why not just donate some of your collection to an existing institution or fund your own wing? Ormond says it's about control.
You have a vision, and you don't have to compromise that vision.
He says by carving their own path, private owners are free to choose what goes in their museum and how it's displayed without worrying about the approval of an existing board.
Some of them have money and some of them have power and influence. It's very political.
Ormond says wealthy art lovers creating their own museums isn't new to Florida. The Rubel, Margulies, and Dela Cruz collections in Miami have been around since the 90s and early 2000s. They're part of the reason the city ranks in the top 10 globally for private museums. And long before that, in Sarasota, the owner of a certain well-known circus funded the construction of a Renaissance-style palace he called the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art.
That was a private museum. And then they didn't have any children. His wife died in 29, and so he left it in his will to the people of the state of Florida.
The Ringling is now one of only three state-run museums in the country. But for people like Tom James, who don't want the government involved in their legacy, Ormond says they have to make careful business decisions.
It's very important for someone who establishes a museum or wants to, upon their death, to work with a very smart attorney to draw up the papers that protects the interests of that individual.
Most importantly, he says they need to be savvy about who they hire to educate visitors about their collection.
You have to be prepared to be the middle person between the art and the public.
And education could help the James Museum, which some critics have noted lacks context. What needs work, they say, is connecting the historical significance of the art depicting Native American and cowboy life. Mark Ormond says collectors have to accept they take on a heightened accountability for their art when they put it in a museum.
When you have it in your offices or your home, then it's a very private experience. But once you establish a place where anyone can come, people are going to start making comparisons to other museums or other collections. And you have to be prepared for that.
And for competition. The best known may be the Dalí Museum, which used state and local funding to bring the private collection of Reynolds and Eleanor Morse to St. Pete in 1982. And now there's the Imagine Museum, another privately owned venture that opened in January to highlight studio glass art. Next year, we'll add the Museum of the Arts and Crafts Movement, which businessman and art collector Rudy Ciccarello is funding mostly with his own money, but also with a little help from the city and Pinellas County. Imagine Museum Deputy Director Jane Buckman says its founder, philanthropist Trish Duggan, saw what was happening in St. Pete's art scene, and that's why she chose it as her museum's home.
She saw it as a community that would appreciate her engagement and her investment.
Buckman says she's not worried having all these museums in St. Pete will oversaturate the market. She sees it as an opportunity to lift all boats. For Florida Matters, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
From intricate goblets to towering church windows, glass has been used to blend beauty with function since ancient times. But it's only in the last 50 years or so that the medium was used to create art solely for the sake of art. As Stephanie Colombini reports, the state's Gulf Coast is becoming a hub for glass collections, with some in the business dubbing it the Glass Coast.
It's about 90 degrees on a recent afternoon in downtown St. Petersburg. Step inside the steel cage that houses the Morian Art Center's Hot Shop and Glass Studio, and it's positively sweltering. Giant fans are cranked on high. Heat waves are coming from furnaces that burn at over 2,000 degrees. Artists Matthew Piepenbrock and Jeremiah Jacobs are dripping with sweat as they perform a demonstration in front of a handful of visitors.
Nobody woke up and said, I want to be a glassblower in Florida, right? Because, man, it gets pretty hot.
And yet, here they are. While Florida may not have the climate for glass blowing, it's become an ideal market for glass enthusiasts. Jacob says he's had as many as 80 people in one session crowd around to watch him and his colleagues transform layers of molten glass into colorful works of art. From Tarpon Springs all the way down to Naples, Florida's Gulf Coast is packed with glass art. Sarasota has more than 200 collectors in two zip codes. The city is also home to the Bash Collection at Ringling College of Art and Design and the new Kotler Koval Glass Pavilion at the Ringling Museum. Here in St. Pete, you can find glass along Central Avenue downtown, and even more in the neighboring Warehouse Arts District at places like Zen Glass Studio and the Duncan McClellan Gallery. McClellan gets a lot of credit from locals for helping put Tampa Bay on the map as a glass destination. He learned to blow glass in Tampa's Ybor City back in the 80s and eventually moved across the bay to convert an abandoned tomato packing plant into a gallery in 2010, where he still works.
Hey, go ahead and give me a puff.
Jeremiah Jacobs, a former clay artist, once lived next door to McClellan, who helped train him in glass for an unusual exchange.
I had the opportunity to start weeding the garden over at Duncan's. For every 4 hours that I'd weed the garden, I'd get 1 hour in the hot shop.
Jacobs may credit McClellan for getting him started in glass, but in a way, he has another artist to thank for his current job, Seattle-based Dale Chihuly. That's because the Morian Hot Shop wouldn't be here without him. The Morian Art Center decided to bring a permanent Chihuly collection to St. Pete in 2010. Now situated in its new building across the street from the Hot Shop, the Chihuly collection boasts icicle-like chandeliers, colorful orbs that appear to be floating on water, and a garden of glass flowers and reeds. Executive Director Andy Slough says it was Chihuly who suggested they provide live demonstrations to accompany his art.
When you're walking around the collection, you're seeing all of this work and wondering, how does he do this? How is it made? And by having the hot shop there, a part of the ticketed entry, people get a fuller picture.
The latest arrival to the region's glass scene is the Imagine Museum, which opened blocks from the Chihuly collection in January. The museum was founded by a philanthropist and a local glass artist. It features over 500 works by 55 artists in the American Studio Glass Movement, which began in 1962 in Toledo, Ohio. Sometimes as you walk past matted sculptures that appear to be made of stone and globes filled with miniature flowers that almost look real, it's hard to remember that it's glass. Deputy Director Jane Buckman says the museum shows people glass art isn't just vases and bowls.
There are many artists from around the world that are working in this medium and making beautiful expression with that glass.
Back at the Morian Hot Shop, glassblower Matthew Piepenbrock says the medium's like a drug to those passionate about it.
Glass is about as addictive as heroin and as expensive.
He says glasswork can sometimes sell for tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars, which wealthy Tampa Bay and Sarasota residents are willing to pay to get their fix.
The average Joe down the road can't just be like, I'm a big glass collector.
Or even a glass artist, as Chihuly Collection Director Andy Slough points out.
It can be very pricey. When you take into account that you're working with furnaces, plus the crucible for the clear glass, plus all the color that you're using, plus the annealers and the electricity, you're getting a lot of dollars.
Whereas with a medium like painting, where anyone can pick up a brush and take a stab at creativity, glass definitely has more of a don't try this at home feel. Jeremiah Jacobs says that's part of what makes the material so appealing.
Just the way it's dripping off of the end of the rod and it's glowing, making its own light, that's really the star of the show over here.
Thank you.
Jacob says most people who watch his demonstrations are less concerned about the final product and more about watching the color and shape of that molten glass come alive. That's why Andy Slough tells visitors at the Chihuly Collection, you don't see glass, you experience it. For Florida Matters, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
Salvador Dali's surrealist, often bizarre painted landscapes were not a product of his imagination, but based on the beaches, rock formations, and dreamlike skies of the Catalonian coast in Spain. A new exhibit at the Dali Museum showcases that real-world inspiration in the form of black and white photographs by photographer Clyde Butcher, who's best known for his photos of the Florida Everglades and Big Cypress. Florida Matters' Delina Miller recently spoke with Butcher at the museum during a preview of the show.
This exhibit here is a stark contrast to Dolly's colorful surrealism, the pieces that we're used to seeing here every day at the museum. How does your work fit into that?
Well, I don't think it would have worked in color. With color, I mean, how would you use the same colors he used? See, black and white shows you the textures, the feeling. You can't compete with his color work. I mean, so black and white, I think, was a really obvious choice of doing this. I think it would have been a disaster in color.
Can you describe a little bit, what are we seeing? What are the places you saw, and why were these places important to Dolly?
Oh, I call it the rock run. There's all these little shapes and forms that he, you know, when you look at clouds, you say, oh, it's a dog, or he did that in his rocks. His rocks gave him the shapes. He gave him this inspiration for different images. Besides the wind, the character of the landscape, I think it was really important because he loved the fishermen because they were really people of the earth.
How long were you in Dolly's homeland, and what was the highlight of your trip?
We were in Spain, I think, for a total of like 3 weeks, but we're only in his area for a week and a half. And it was probably, I could have been more time, but I think we got the feeling. Do you think we had the feeling of what he did here? I think that we have, but I didn't realize it was there was cactus. It was actually a desert. I didn't realize Spain was a desert. They had cypress trees, which they're not cypress trees like Florida. They're more deserty type. And then they have the olive trees, which was a desert type plant. Yeah, I didn't realize it was a desert, but the Mediterranean gave that warmth.
What's your favorite work by Dolly?
I like the clock. That's pretty neat. Some of the ones he got involved in Christ was kind of interesting. He was not happy with the war, because he had to leave because of World War II. But I think by doing that, he got hooked up with Disney.
That was photographer Clyde Butcher speaking with Florida Matters reporter Delina Miller. That's it for today's show. You can find photos and video of the museums featured in our Art Populi series on our website, wusfnews.org. And we always like to hear from you. What are some of your favorite experiences with Tampa Bay's art museums? Share your stories on our Facebook page or tweet at Florida Matters. And you'll find more of the conversation on our podcast, Florida Matters More. Just search for it on your phone's podcast app. Our show is a production of WUSF Public Media. The producer is Stephanie Colombini. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.